You may be anxious to head out to the garden and start digging in. Maybe you've already been out there and doing a little raking and cleaning up in the garden. Unfortunately, for many plants, it's still probably too cold to get a little chilly yet. Let's put it that way, to get them outside. Larry Mueller here. Welcome to another edition of Garden Talk. We'll find out what you can do right now as we visit with Lisa Johnson. Lisa, the Dane County Horticulture Educator for UW Extension. And we are taking your questions at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. And pretty much when Lisa's on, you know, we can go the gamut. We can talk about diseases, we can talk about planting, we might talk, she can talk about trees sometimes and shrubs, certainly plants. She knows everything. I think she knows everything, but she doesn't know.
Not so much.
Anyway, it's always fun to have her, and you can join in again, 1-800-642-1234, email at talk@wpr.org, or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Well, here we are, mid-April. Are there still some things you could start indoors?
Sure, there are. You can definitely start some things like eggplants, some of the later season crops, the cucumbers and so on. Usually with the melon and cucumber type crops, I don't recommend having them be transplanted. So we usually start them in peat pots if we're going to start them inside.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. We're just having a little bit of an issue here, but we'll get that straightened out. Hopefully you can hear what's going on, Lisa. Okay, well, adjust the volume if you can. And we have callers online. There are other things that we can do other than starting seeds indoors. And what are you working on in your own garden right now?
I haven't even gotten out to my own garden yet, I'm ashamed to say, although I can see what's going on out there. Actually, I had a lot of rabbit damage this last year.
Oh.
So it's a bloodbath in my yard. I lost 5 shrubs. It's really bad. So things they hadn't gone after before, so I didn't have them fenced. Oh, well. But, yeah, it's a good time to start transplanting perennials. Once you see them starting to come up, you can do that, or dividing perennials. It's a good time now to plant your peas and your potatoes and your onions outside. Generally, we say the 15th of April, tax day, is a good day to do that. Now, this time last year, when it was so cold, I would have said, hold off a little bit. It's been warmer this year, so I'm telling people, go for it. I'm going to try this afternoon to put in some lettuce and spinach and so on. So the soil is warm enough for that now, and definitely time. It's getting even a little late to put on your crabgrass preventer, but that should be done soon.
If not, right. And the potatoes, where can we get our seed potatoes? Places like Klein's have them?
Yep.
No problems there. Okay, Sue in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi, Sue.
Hi. I got some hemlock about 3 years ago through the county, and I wanted to transplant them. Is it too early to do that?
No, I'd say you could. You're in Milwaukee. Are you on the lake, or are you
close to the lake?
You're close to the lake?
Five miles from the lake.
5 miles from the lake. You could probably do that now. Are they starting to bud out? Or there, you said they're hemlocks, so it's harder to tell.
I haven't really noticed any new budding, but I haven't looked that closely.
Yeah. I'd say you could go ahead and do that now. If they're 3 years old, they're not going to have that deep of a root system, so I would think that would be fine.
Do you recommend fertilizing?
No, not the first year after planting.
Any kind of transplant.
Right,
okay.
Yeah. Okay. Just keep them well watered this year and then next year. Generally, we don't recommend a whole lot of fertilizer for trees, but when they have undergone transplanting, the year after that, you can use a slow release. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. Thank you.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. So this time of year, If you're lucky, you can get some bare root stock yet, can we? Or?
Yes, yes. I'm sure it's flying off the shelves now. So.
Yeah, I bet.
But, yeah, it's when the spring is warm, it tends to go a lot faster. But, yes, you can still get that.
Yeah, and I kind of like it. I guess if I was going to plant a tree right now, I'd probably go with bare root. But just because of the potential planting issues if you've got a potted one.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the potted ones, I would wait a little while yet.
Mark in Oshkosh has something for us. Hi, Mark.
Hello. I threw down a bunch of dirt in some low spots around my yard yesterday, and I was thinking about putting some grass seed on it this weekend. Would that be a good idea?
Usually I would tell people to wait another week or so, but since it's been trending warmer, we are supposed to go down to 33 here in the Madison area, and I know you're up in Oshkosh, so I'm not sure what the forecast is for your area. You're probably okay, and if you're going to put down some straw or something over it, I would think that would be all right because it's been warm enough.
Okay.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Mark. Appreciate it. And on to Jeff in Beloit. Jeff, hi. Thank you for calling.
You're welcome, Larry. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I'm thinking of putting in some raised vegetable garden beds, and I'm wondering about the height and the soil mixture and where can I get it?
Mm-hmm. Oh, sure. Well, the height, in general, most of our vegetables, if you have an 8-inch or a 12-inch bed, that should be fine. 6-inch, I think, is not quite deep enough for tomatoes and things that need a little bit more support, so I usually recommend 8 to 12-inch deep. And you can use any potted or potting soil mix. The soilless mixes are best. I don't recommend you using straight compost or straight topsoil because it tends to just pack up and become too heavy. You can mix in about a quarter, a 1-to-4 ratio of compost or topsoil with that soilless plant or potting soil mix, but in general, we want it to be pretty light and fluffy in the beds.
Yep.
Oh, okay, so you're saying the potting soil mix would be 50% and then 1/4 compost and 1/4 topsoil would probably work?
No, you would have 3/4 of the potting soil mix and then 1/4 of either compost or topsoil.
Okay. And what would your preference be over the topsoil or the compost?
It really doesn't matter
much.
Six to one,
half a dozen
of
the other.
Okay. All right.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling, Jeff. Appreciate your call. But you're doing a good thing. And I'd go for a foot, but of course, that's a lot of soil.
Yeah. Yeah, and some people want to, keep that down a little bit. It kind of depends on the lumber that you're able to find. If you're able to find the 6-inch, then, it's easy to get two of them, and there you go. We like to use, at our teaching garden, we like to use decking boards that are made of composite lumber, which is part plastic and part recycled wood, because it will never rot.
Mm-hmm.
And you can get that either as a solid or as a hollow core. If you get hollow core, you have to have these ends that cost $1 each to stick in to it, so you don't get yellow jackets and other things that you don't want nesting in the hollow areas. And the hollow ones are a little bit less sturdy. They tend to bow out a little bit.
But, of course, they're probably cheaper.
Yep, exactly. You got it. So what we do with those is we put some uprights that are about a foot. We usually get them 18 inches, so you can put 6 inches into the ground. But just stakes that we screw the middles of those boards to, so that bowing out doesn't happen so much.
You were talking about those roots, and I remember last year with the straw bales that I had some tomatoes on them, and then when I pulled out the tomatoes at the end of the season, the roots had gone the whole length.
Yeah, tomatoes can get really deep if you plant them in a whiskey barrel or something like that.
They'll go right to the bottom.
Yeah, or a 5-gallon bucket. But you can grow them in, 12 inches, and that should be fine. But I wouldn't grow them in 6.
No. Bill in West Salem, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hello, Larry.
Yes, hi. Thanks
and
for calling.
And your guest.
Lisa.
Wonderful program. Mm-hmm. I have a question here. It's a 3-part question. I'll run it off real fast. Number one, I have rose bushes. Question number one is when to prune. Question number two, how much back do I prune it? And number three, type of fertilizer to use.
All right. I've got them all written down there. First, we got roses.
Okay. Bill, can you tell me what type of roses these are? Are they
bush? They're a bush rose. Yeah.
Okay, so they're a shrub rose.
Shrub rose, there
you
go.
Yeah, okay, so not a hybrid tea. We usually recommend for shrub roses is that you don't need to prune them back necessarily quite as much as a hybrid tea because there isn't as much dye back. So you would do it mostly for shaping purposes.
Okay.
And what you would do is usually if you need to prune out anything that's in the middle, like branches that are going in the wrong direction, or if you just want to thin out the middle a little bit so you get better air circulation and less black spot disease and less mildew and so on, that's helpful. The other thing that you want to do is when you prune to an out-facing bud. And an out-facing bud is just what it sounds like. It's a bud that faces to the outside of the plant rather than facing back in because you don't want to encourage growth going back into the center.
Gotcha.
So I would say for a shrub rose, pruning back, a quarter of the height is probably sufficient. Mm-hmm. And doing that shaping and thinning on the inside of it should be sufficient. And certainly anything that's dead, take that out. Or if it's dead partway down, cut until you can see white pith in the center of the branch so that you've cut back to undiseased or live tissue.
And fertilizing, would you fertilize any?
Yeah, I usually do recommend fertilizer for roses. Now, shrub roses don't necessarily need as much as hybrid teas. They're much more robust plant and less picky about their circumstances. They don't need all the pampering that a hybrid tea needs. So you probably could even get away with a slow-release fertilizer. Any of the granular products like Osmocote would be fine. That's just one of them. I know Scott's has a slow-release product. There are many other brand names out there to choose from. If you wanted to use a bagged fertilizer product, a 10-10-10 ought to be plenty.
There we go. Thank you so much, Bill, for calling. Appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Dane County, our guest today. I'm Larry Mueller. Cynthia Schuster, our on-air producer today here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Gardening season is here, and on Garden Talk, we're visiting with Lisa Johnson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller. Thank you so much for listening in. Questions, give us a call at 1-800-642-1234, 1-800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. And I think an email from Arlene in New Berlin who said, I have gladiola and iris bulbs that are clumped together. When's the best time to transplant them and how deep in the soil should they go?
Okay, well...
Sounds like she's already got them out of the...
Yeah, gladiola bulbs typically aren't hardy here. Now, maybe they survive in New Berlin, but Typically, they don't survive over winter and have to be dug up. But if yours are alive, what you need to do is separate the two. Iris is best actually transplanted in fall, like in September or late August. But it sounds like you you need to do something now. So the gladiolas should be transplanted usually around the beginning of May. And how deep in the soil should they go? The rule of thumb with bulbs, and actually gladiolas are corms, but same difference. Usually you want it to be about two times the height of the bulb deep. So you can look at that. And the irises, the rhizome should be planted horizontally, and they should be planted so that half of the rhizome is above the soil and half of it is below.
There we go. Good straightforward tips there. Matt in Green Bay, your turn. Hi, Matt.
Hi. Great show. Love the input and interesting quick one. I've got a raspberry garden, an heirloom garden that my mother planted for me. She just recently passed away. And I want to keep this thing going as kind of a tribute to her. So we just put about 5 or 6 inches of composted horse manure, 3-year-old composted horse manure, on this raspberry garden. I'm wondering what's the best way to make sure to take care of this thing. What's your best recommendation for making plump, beautiful raspberries happen? And to keep these things growing.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Raspberries, I guess what I need to know is if you know if these are summer-bearing raspberries or whether they are fall-blooming raspberries.
Well, we've got a little bit of a mixture. It was from my grandmother's original raspberry patch.
Okay.
And they did add in some what we would call everbearing, so they give you two crops, one in summer, one in fall.
Right.
And then we have some that are just, I believe, summer bearing.
Okay. Are the two separated or are they?
Yeah, they're on separate ends of the patch.
Oh, wonderful. Okay. My problem is when people tell me, well, they're mixed together and I don't know which one is which. So the problem is that they have separate pruning needs. So with a summer bearing raspberry, this is going to be a lot easier since you've got them separated, but the summer bearing ones are on a 2-year life cycle. So their first year they produce a cane that does not produce any fruit. The second year that cane will start to fruit and produce for you that year. And then that cane either dies or becomes unproductive. So when you're pruning, usually we recommend that people do that during the dormant season. If you haven't done it yet this year, I suggest you getting to it as soon as you can. And what you do...
My mom pruned them off for me last year. Or last
she did.
Fall,
okay.
Winter. Yeah,
well,
she saw it coming and she wanted to make sure they were taken care of.
Aww.
I don't have her for the knowledge.
Aww.
Oh, man.
What a mom.
Yeah, what a mom.
She was awesome.
Well, so she's got you set up for this year. And so next winter or spring, what you'll need to do is the ones that have fruited this year, you'll be able to tell because they'll be branched and you'll be able to tell where the fruiting clusters were. You cut those down to the ground on the old or on the canes that fruited this year. On the canes that didn't fruit this year for the summer-bearing raspberries, you cut about a quarter of the top of those off, and you thin them out so that there's about 4 to 6 per linear foot. Then for the ever-bearing raspberries, and all of this information, if you're not, it sounds like you're in a car, so you probably mm-hmm. can't write this down. You can get this information at our publication on growing raspberries in Wisconsin, which is at the Learning Store, which is learningstore.uwex.edu. So, carrying on here,
okay,
mm-hmm. learningstore.uwex.edu, and if you search for raspberries, or when you get to the site, on the left-hand side, you go to, I believe it's Lawns and Gardens, and then Fruits will come up, and you can click on that, or you can just search for raspberries. So for the ever-bearing raspberries, those are going to produce new fruiting canes every year. So they're on a one-year cycle. So every year those can be cut to the ground, or you can cut them halfway back, get a spring crop on the half, and then remove those canes as soon as they've fruited in spring.
There you go. Good luck, and you had a great mom from the sound of it. Thanks,
yeah.
Matt. Thank you very much for calling. Yeah, you bet. Thank you so much. You can join in, too. The number to call, 800-642-1234. Email us at talk@wpr.org. Kay in Wausau up next. Hi, Kay.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call, and welcome, Lisa.
Thank you.
Anyway, I maybe did something real stupid here. I was raking, and we have some moss in different areas around the house and around some trees, and I started, it started coming up, and it came up in sheets, and I picked this all up, and so now I have bare ground, mm-hmm. and I'm wondering, will grass seed grow there, and if so, what kind? But did I really mess something up by pulling all that moss up?
No, not a bit.
It'll probably come right back.
Yeah, that is the sad truth. Usually moss will grow in lawns in areas that it's hard for the grass to grow. So in your question about will grass seed grow there, it might germinate there, but in the long run you may have trouble getting grass to establish well in that area. In order to give it the best shot, what I would do is kind of rake up the ground in those areas so that you have a nice seed bed before you put the grass seed in. If you're going to use grass seed in that area rather than some kind of perennial ground cover, I would use a grass seed that is adapted to shade. So that's going to be a fescue mix. And we do have a really great publication called Growing Grass in Shade that's at the Learning Store that you might want to check out online. And so what you should do, again, is you rake up the ground, you put in your grass seed, use a shady grass mix, but I wouldn't expect a whole lot in areas where you have fairly deep shade or under evergreens or that kind
yeah.
of thing.
Yep, there you go.
Okay, well, what about putting hostas there?
Hostas sure. would be great.
Yeah, it'd be perfect.
Oh, okay. Well, thank you very much. I appreciate your time.
Yep,
you
thanks a
welcome.
Lot for calling. Yeah, that would be, hostas would like that area, mm-hmm. I think. Joseph on Facebook has a help question. He says, I have a question about grass being killed by dogs and how to prevent it. Every year it happens. I'm tired of redoing the lawn every year. And so I don't know if it's Joseph's dogs. And so if they're peeing on all over the lawn.
Or whether it's his neighbors bringing theirs over.
Or if it's the neighbors. But if it's his own, there's things you can do. If it's the neighbors, there's other things you can do.
If it's your dog, obviously, making sure that they don't use the yard as the area that you have them pee in would be the first step. If it's your neighbors, talking to them about what's happening to your yard and could they please keep their dogs off the yard, I guess would be the first step there. Unfortunately, there is no grass seed that is going to be resistant to high ammonia dog mm-hmm. urine. Keeping the dogs out of the area is the best thing that I can recommend.
Yeah. I mean, you can go in afterwards and you can pour a lot of water down because it's, you've got those salts that will... Mm-hmm. sort of
desiccate and burn.
Yeah. In the end, if you wait long enough, isn't it really going to come back anyway, the lawn?
It might.
Depends on how much rain you get.
Yeah, right, exactly. And if it happens during a drought when the grass is stressed anyway, that might be enough to kill it.
Yeah.
And I don't know whether this is happening when Joseph is at home or not, or whether he just realized what's happening afterwards when he sees the damage.
Yeah. Yeah, but if it's your own dogs, Patricia McConnell always said, you know, she trained her dogs just to go in one spot.
Yeah.
In the back of the lawn.
Yep.
So, you know, so they weren't going everywhere. But, of course, it's too late for that now.
Yeah.
Terry in Green Bay. Hi, thank you for calling.
Yeah, hi. I want to ask Lisa a question. This is in, with the use of Milorganite, I've got some balsams here in my field. Maybe 8, some maybe 10 feet tall. Do you think the use of Milorganite, you know, sprinkled around the perimeter like the drip line or whatever, wouldn't that be of any help to these trees?
Sure. It's a fairly low impact product. I'm trying to remember what the analysis is on that. I think it's less than 10, 10, 10. So I don't think that it would cause a whole lot of harm.
No, I don't see why you couldn't.
Yeah, and particularly if you're trying to use it to keep deer and other animals out, it can be very useful.
Yeah, that's an unintended good consequence.
Yes, yes, and some people do use it with that consequence in mind.
Mm-hmm. There you go, Terry. Thank you. Paul in Green Bay. Hello. Thank you for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I have a question on wisteria, purple wisteria trees. Is this too early to plant? I know they're not from the area. I just had them shipped in from Carolinas. I know we're getting 30 degrees for low next week in Green Bay area again.
Yeah, first of all, I take, are these the American variety or the Oriental?
Yes.
Okay, good, because the Oriental isn't invasive.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I was right up on that. They
yeah.
Get those out of control.
I yeah. would wait until early May with those, if at all possible.
Okay. And so, I think the email with Joseph on the dogs.
Yeah.
I got the same problem, but what I found was a mixture of just a vegetable oil, peppercorns, and some minced garlic, and just sprinkle that around the yard, and it's quite pungent for the dog, but it doesn't hurt the grass.
So you mean to keep dogs off
yeah.
your grass?
How to keep them off.
Oh, yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, that's not, yeah, well, that's,
you know,
what is it again? What do you use?
Senses. I just use a vegetable oil, and then whole peppercorns. You can crush them up, crack them however
yeah.
you like, and a bit of minced garlic.
Hmm.
It's a bit damp and gooey, but you just throw it around in little chunks. The dogs can smell it a long way away. They don't like it.
They don't like it. All right. Thanks, Paul. Appreciate the call. You know, I was thinking about this. I you know, do a little 5K in the mornings through the neighborhood, and there's a couple of neighbors, a few blocks away from me anyway, but there are some nice signs that are up against trees now that say, do not have your dog go in this yard.
Mm-hmm.
You know, and just
I
please, and
yeah.
it says, and nice, you know.
Yeah. Yeah, I think that's reasonable.
Yeah, I think that's a reasonable thing to ask of
yeah.
people. And those happen to be on a place where there's a park right across the street. So it's one of those, you know, you're sure to get high use of people
mm-hmm.
and probably pets
mm-hmm.
too. Margo in Prairie du Chien. Hi, thanks for calling.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. I have a question about Canadian. I need a privacy hedge.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
And I order plants, so I get a bazillion catalogs. But I got one for a Sub-Zero Hardy Canadian Hemlock. And I want it as a privacy hedge. Is that a good thing to plant, or am I going to be out, because I'm elderly, am I going to be out trimming it to keep it in control, or could I just plant it and have the privacy?
Canada hemlock is a native here, so the answer to your other question about it being invasive is no, it's not invasive. I have seen it used in a hedge situation at Chicago Botanic, but it does require a lot of trimming because it grows naturally in a kind of Christmas tree shape, so to try and use it for a hedge, it's more of a thin evergreen rather than a thicker evergreen.
Mm-hmm.
So if you keep it trimmed, it will cause more branching and cause it to be thicker, but it does require quite a bit of maintenance. So I would use a arborvitae, which,
you know.
Sorry?
A Techne arborvitae?
Techne is okay. That's one of the taller growing ones. You could, if you wanted one that you're not going to have to trim very much, you might want to try Emerald arborvitae, but that one's not very fast growing. So Techne's probably a good choice, or one called Wintergreen.
Okay.
Mm-hmm.
Couple. Thank you so much. Oh, I love your program.
Thank you, Margot. We love that you love it, too. I appreciate your call very much. What about you? Do you have a question for our guest today, Lisa Johnson? Lisa, of course, the horticulture educator for UW Extension in Dane County. Always love having her on, and you can get right to her at 1-800-642-1234. Or email us at talk@WPR.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Daniel in Spring Valley up next. Hi, Daniel. Thank you for calling.
Yes, thank you. I am looking to thin out my strawberry plants.
Okay.
And I'd like to remove at least half of them. What was 100 is probably now 1,000. And my program was to maybe spray... Roundup on an area of the grass and then till it up after a few weeks and then move those plants. Is that a good way to do it? And when can I do it?
So you mean you would kill off an area where you want to put the strawberries?
The strawberries, yeah.
Okay.
I think
okay.
That's what I got. That is a fine way to kill off the grass. Do realize, though, that when you till, you're going to be bringing up a number of weed seeds. So you're going to want to mulch fairly heavily that first year. What you might want to do after you till is wait a couple of weeks and, you know, when the weeds come up, kill them off again with Roundup, and then wait another week or 10 days, whatever your Roundup product says is the recommended wait time before you replant, and then you can put your strawberries in. I would wait until, probably the second week in May or so. You could start killing off the grass now. If you wanted to, because Roundup has to be used when it's above 40 degrees, which we certainly are in that area. But I'd like to get the strawberries up a little bit more and photosynthesizing before you start transplanting them.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Once I move these plants, are they stressed, and do I need to nip the blossoms this year?
Yes. Yep.
Yep.
That would be a good idea.
All right. Good. Thank you, Dan, for calling. Appreciate your call. We had Brianna on Facebook who has a question about butternut squash. And she says, I'm trying butternut squash and round zucchini this year as well. Should I start them inside now or plant outside after the last frost date?
That's a really good question. Usually it's recommended that you plant squash or zucchini outside, that you direct seed them, but you have to wait long enough that the soil gets to be at the appropriate temperature. And I don't remember off the top of my head what that is. I do have a very nice handout at the office that was put together by one of our master gardeners, Marilyn Salee, on soil temperatures and seeds. I think it's something 50? Like it's at least 50. It might even be 60.
So usually
with butternut and squash, you're going to want to wait till the end of May or maybe even early June to put those in outside. Some people like to plant them in hills. If you're planting them in raised beds, the soil will warm up a little bit faster, so probably end of May rather than beginning of June. If you do want to start them inside, though, and that's okay if you want to do that, but realizing that these guys have pretty brittle roots and they don't like transplanting. So what I do if I'm going to start them inside, and we do some of that for our Master Gardener plant sale, which I will also say is May 17th this year at the Dane County Extension Office. Check out our webpage. We do start them inside in peat pots, and then when you want to transplant them, you just take the pot gently apart and put the plant gently in the ground, and that usually will preserve the root system better than if you were to totally depot the plant.
There we go. On to Barb in Nakusa. Barb, hi. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I have a five-year-old asparagus bed that I have to move. And
ooh.
I would, when can I do that? And any tips on how to do it?
Ooh.
Yeah. Boy, that's tough. You won't be getting a whole lot of asparagus for probably a couple years after you move it, just to let you know.
Okay.
They can be moved, but did you plant them in the traditional way where you plant them like 8 inches deep and put soil over the top?
Yep, and we made kind of burrows
to
put them on. Yeah.
Okay, so you're going to need to go down, fairly deep. To get all of the roots. It can be done early in the season. As soon as you start to see it above the soil, when the spears are starting to come up, I would not harvest spears this year if you are going to move them. Because they're going to need all of that photosynthetic food that's going to be produced in order to compensate for root damage and get established in the new spot. So, yes, you can do it early in the season here.
So I wait till they come up a little bit, or do I just go in and try to find the roots now?
I would wait until they've come up a little bit.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
Yeah, I think you'll have better luck with that because you'll have a better idea of where the roots are instead of stabbing around with a shovel.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're welcome. Well, good luck. It's going to be a little chore to get that done right, I think. So be careful.
Yeah.
Be careful out there. Lisa Johnson, our guest, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller. For Garden Talk, here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Thanks so much for listening in on the Ideas Network. For this edition of Garden Talk, we visit with Lisa Johnson, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for tuning in today. Call us with your questions about gardening at 1-800-642-1234. You can email us at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at the Larry Mueller Show. And let's go to Jolie next in Wausau. Jolie, thank you for calling. Hi.
Hi. Thank you for listening.
Mm-hmm.
I have a question for you for pampas grass.
Okay.
We've had pampas grass, and I made the mistake of putting little plants in other areas, which now it's spread too much. And I was wondering, we have a well system. So I'm just wondering, how do you get rid of that pampas grass?
We lost you for a little bit about when you started talking about a well.
Oh, I'm sorry. With the pampas grass, we have a well system, so we're not city sewer and water.
Okay.
So I'm hesitant of using Roundup. I mean, it is away from the house, but still, I don't know.
Okay.
Yeah. Other than digging it up, an herbicide is your other choice, and Roundup would be one that I would recommend for controlling pampas grass. Mm. So I would say one or the other.
Can you smother it?
It is being a perennial and a fairly aggressive perennial. Usually smothering works better on annuals or annual weeds. I don't think that it's going to work very well on this particular plant.
Mm.
I mean, you could certainly try it in a small area.
See how it works.
Yeah, and see how it works. But I don't think it's going to be real successful.
Thanks for calling, Julie. Appreciate your call. You know, at the start of the program, I mentioned emerald ash borer, and we haven't gotten to that, and I'd like to do that before we get too far along here and we are out of time. So what about an update on the emerald ash borer?
Well, we are unfortunately continuing to see it progress across Dane County as well as other counties in the state. Emerald ash borer is something that if you have an ash tree within 15 miles of a find, that you should, if you want to keep that ash tree around, consider protecting it preventatively. And there are a couple different insecticides that you can use to do that. The one that we usually recommend because it has the best efficacy and lasts the longest is a product called Triage that can be our turf and insect specialist Chris Williamson has done a lot of research on this, and he has found that the insecticide lasts about 3 years. Now, it is something that has to be injected by a company. Most of the products that are available to homeowners are only good for 1 year, and some of them, particularly the ones containing imidacloprid, which is a neonicotinoid product, is potentially more toxic. But the main problem is that, you know, you have to apply it every year. It is a lot cheaper. But the emamectin benzoate, the Triage, is injected directly into the tree, so it's not going to be in the soil.
Mm-hmm.
So I think there are benefits either way, but you do need to make a decision to do something about your tree if, you know, make a decision as to whether or not you want to keep it.
Yeah.
We do have a good fact sheet that is called something on the order of... I believe the title is My Ash Tree Worth Treating for EAB? And you can find that on the Wisconsin Horticulture website, which is hort.uwex.edu. And that one will give you some tips as to how to evaluate the health of your tree and the structure of your tree and give you some idea of kind of what the economics of keeping it around are going to be.
Sure. But if you've got an ash tree and it's within a few miles of...
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
If you don't
treat it...
You lose it.
Yeah, you will lose it.
Yeah.
And it's a very frightening and unfortunate thing that we're going to be losing a lot of tree canopy in woodlot areas and park areas and wild areas.
That's really unfortunate.
Yeah.
Really unfortunate. Karen in Muskego, thank you for waiting. It is your turn next. Hi.
Hi. I have, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
I have raspberry bushes, and every year I'm dealing with the ugly Japanese beetles.
Oh, yes.
And I
One
know
of their
that,
favorite foods.
right. That and rose bushes.
Mm-hmm.
But I want to know what I could treat the raspberry bushes with that. I mean, I do use soapy water. That seems to help a little bit, but I'm out there all the time doing that, or I'm catching them in a bottle of soapy water. So there's got to be something out there they don't like. I could treat them because it is an edible fruit. I don't want to, you know, discard
right.
the fruit, but, you know, what would you suggest?
How big is your area, by the way?
Yeah, thank you.
It's got to be maybe about... maybe about 2 yards, 3 yards. I don't know. I'm trying to, you know, the back half of my garden.
9 feet?
Yeah, maybe that's it. That could be a good guess.
Okay, so that's a manageable area. That's
sure.
not huge, which is great. First of all, how long have you had Japanese beetles?
Oh, it just seems like they've been here for at least 10 years.
Okay.
You know, I mean, I've been monitoring them every year, so I was told like 12 years is could be in a, you know, a life, you know, that time frame, but I'm not sure.
Okay. They do tend to, when you've had them for about 5 to 10 years, they do tend to go down in population, and, you know, some of them will move on to other areas. But it sounds like this is continuing to be an issue for you. I have some raspberries as well, and I have Japanese beetles too. The one thing, of course, we don't recommend is using the beetle traps because research has shown that that brings in four times as many beetles as you would have had without the traps. So I think that what you're doing with the soapy water is great. You can use neem oil. However, you can't use it when it's producing because there's being a soft fruit like that. It's if you don't want any neem on your fruit, it's you can't wash it off, obviously.
Right.
So it is a problem. I wish that I had a really good solution for you.
Sometimes you could probably try to cover.
Yeah, I've had people build supports like stakes around the plant and then put a net over it. You know, like what you would use for window screening. The problem is that when the flowers need pollinating by the bees, you can't do that because then the bees can't get in to do the pollination and you don't get your fruit developing.
Yeah.
So it can work once the majority of the fruit is developing. But if you have an everbearing type that needs pollination all season, there's really no good solution I can give you. I think you're doing really what you need to do.
Okay. All right. Thank you very much.
Yeah. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. Oh, man. What about Cindy in Antioch, Illinois? What's on your mind?
Slugs and hosta is on my mind.
Okay.
Oh, yeah.
I have a recipe that I'd like to know if this works and how it's used. My recipe is from the UW Extension, and it says I should put 20% household ammonia, one part ammonia to four parts water, and use a sprinkling can and sprinkle it around the hosta plants. So do I sprinkle it over the hosta? Oh, the pips. I'm sorry. So it would be this time of the year when the pips are coming up is when
Okay. Yeah, before the... Okay, and is this from one of our fact sheets, or is this...
I think I got this in Paddock Lake for the UW Extension Spring into Gardening.
Huh.
Okay. I'll be honest with you, it's not something that I've heard of before. Typically, when I'm telling people to do various things for slugs, I would recommend something like escargot, which is a pellet that is iron phosphate, and you can put that down this time of year, and it's a... It's a less toxic option than some of the commercial slug baits that contain chemical metal axyl or something like that.
And garden supply stores would carry that?
Yeah, escargot is one of them, and Sluggo is the other one.
Oh yes,
those two brand names. Diatomaceous earth is a possibility, but I think it's more of a possibility earlier in the year before the hosta canopy comes up.
Okay.
The thing I would worry about with the ammonia is, first of all, I'm not technically allowed to recommend something that isn't blessed by the EPA, and so I couldn't technically recommend that. I am curious about the research on it, though. So if you do find out where you got it from, I'd be happy to hear about that. The other thing that people do, of course, is the good old beer traps that people put out. And some people will even put out things like rolled newspapers that the slugs can go in overnight, and then you just squish up the newspaper in the morning and remove it. Putting down boards or other things that slugs can collect on overnight is another slug removal sort of thing.
Mm-hmm. When you use the escargot or the sluggo, do you need to put that on multiple times during the growing season because it, you know, would break down?
Yeah, it is a good idea to do that. I usually recommend putting it down two or three times during the year if we have really heavy slug pressure.
Mm-hmm.
Putting it down really early so that, you know, this time of year, so that slugs that are either have overwintered and coming out or ones that are coming out of eggs, that you get them early before their population goes up.
Yeah, nip it in the bud.
Right, exactly.
Okay.
And then if we do have, you know, you can put it on maybe a month later again just to refresh it.
Mm-hmm.
And then usually once later in the season.
Okay, great idea. Thank you.
All right. Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate your call. And we had something from Gene in La Crosse, an email. Planted two hemlock trees in our yard about 4 years ago. They're in full sun with nice black soil. We planted them because we read they grow very fast, but ours hasn't grown more than about 6 inches in the last 4 years. Any ideas why? I would think with any tree, there's at least a year or so mm-hmm. where the tree is getting its roots.
Yeah, well, where it's establishing. There's something called transplant shock, and the bigger the tree is, actually, the more time it spends in transplant shock. For every inch of tree caliper, and that's the measurement of the diameter of the tree at 4 feet off the ground, if you plant a tree that is an inch in diameter, it's a season of transplant shock. If it's 2 inches, it's two seasons of transplant shock. So it could have something to do with the size of the trees that you put in. Hopefully, when they were planted, the burlap and wire basket was removed if it was mm-hmm. A bald and burlap tree, because if it isn't, that can significantly affect the root development. If it was a potted tree, hopefully the roots were untangled
and
you know,
spread out.
Yeah, and spread out. The texture of your soil, if it's heavy clay versus loam, would make a difference, how you've watered it and so on.
So lots of things to consider there, and some great advice from Lisa Johnson. Lisa, horticulture educator for UW Extension in Dane County, our guest here on Garden Talk on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. Great to have you along on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. You are listening to Garden Talk. Larry Mueller here, and really pleased to have back Dane County UW Extension horticulture educator Lisa Johnson. How is your garden going, or how's the planting going at least? Hope you have some good plans in mind and some good practices in mind. Call us with your questions at 800-642-1234. Email at talk@wpr.org or post on our Facebook page at The Larry Mueller Show. Lisa, we have Annabelle in Fort Atkinson with a question for you. So let's go there. Annabelle, hi. Thank you for calling.
Thank you very much. About 4 years ago, I bought some small seedlings that were at our farmer's market as a kind of a fundraising thing by the organization that sponsors the market. I brought them home and I planted, and they were spindly looking.
Okay.
They didn't look very healthy, but I think I've managed to keep two alive.
Now, these are hazelnuts?
Yes, hazelnut trees.
American hazelnut or European hazelnut? Or do you know?
I don't know. I still have the literature, but I'm assuming it was okay to have, because they're very interested in doing things that are green.
Okay.
Anyway, I have, where I've planted them, I don't want it to be a tree. I would prefer that it would be like a shrub. And I did read in the literature that they provided that you had to have two that were growing in order to have nuts, so I don't know whether I would ever have nuts. But my question is this. I've been sort of babying it, and I've thought that I really have just one main stem. when I looked the other day, it looked to me like that there was a branch and of it maybe 4 or 5 inches below the top of the main branch, which is probably 18 to 24 inches from the ground.
Okay.
And my question is this. I know usually if you tip something, you encourage growth from the bottom.
Mm-hmm.
Should I do that since I'm not interested in having it be a tree?
Yeah. Most hazelnuts, American hazelnut is a shrub. It's a suckering shrub. It usually forms a thicket. So I'm kind of surprised that it's only producing one stem for you. That's why I asked about whether it might be a European hazelnut or even a Turkish hazelnut. Turkish hazelnut is a tree form critter that is grown for shade and for ornamental value, whereas the American hazelnut is a thicket-forming shrub that is grown for nuts or for renovating or restoring a native area in general. So if it is indeed American hazelnut, yeah, I don't see any problem with tipping, as you called it, pruning it back so that you want to encourage some growth from the base.
Would you do that also on what I'm looking at now as possibly a branch that is off that main stem? Would you tip that also?
Yeah, you can do that. Sure. It'll make it bushier.
Okay, all right. And I have another one that's growing that I'm not sure what it is, but I guess I'll just tip it and then
find out.
Yeah.
Maybe some similarity in leaves that I can be sure of what it is.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, good luck with that, Annabelle. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. I want to give Dorothy in Green Bay a chance to join us next. Dorothy, hi. Thank you for calling.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call. I was wondering what about that Asian crazy worm, and is there something we should do to not get that in our yards, or what should we do, and what should we think about it?
Okay, well, the DNR is monitoring that, and Larry, can you scroll back down there to the phone number? There is a person at the DNR that is handling monitoring of that creature. Her name is Bernadette Williams, and
okay.
If you do see them at your place, either in your compost or your garden or whatever, she would like you to give her a call and report that. And her number is 608-266-0624. So that's 608-266-0624 for Bernadette Williams. And
okay.
She's monitoring where we are finding that. I wish I could tell you that there's a way to keep them out, but we have been finding that they've been showing up in some unexpected places. They've been found in the Arboretum, of all places, in Madison. So that is one of the places they've been found around the state. And I think they're figuring that they came in compost that may have been transported. Not really sure how they would have gotten to the Arboretum, since I'm not sure that I think they probably make their own compost.
Yeah.
Somehow or other they got in. And
What do they look
very much like an earthworm, but they have a ring on them. The mm-hmm. Is that called a clitellum? I'd have to look mm-hmm. that up. That is smooth. And they are pretty much identified by the way that they move, which is that they thrash around. They're a lot more than an average earthworm that tries to escape you, but they actually kind of throw themselves into the air and thrash around. And that tells you that that's what they are. Interestingly enough, though, the regular earthworms are also not native to the U.S., and there has been in the past number of years monitoring efforts. You know, it's not bad to have them in your garden, for example. We do value what they do in the vegetable garden, but if they escape into woodland areas, they can actually have a big effect on the soil ecology. They tend to eat all the leaf litter and that, you know, trees depend on to keep moisture and to keep the mycorrhiza in the soil that they work with to take up nutrition. And it also can affect some of the macroorganisms in the woodland, you know, birds and so on that depend on leaf litter in different ways and insects and so on. So kind of an interesting problem. But the crazy worms really do a number on your soil. They tend to pellet it up into these small, hard little particles, and they can be very prolific.
Dorothy, thanks so much for calling. I'm glad we had a chance to talk about that. Again, the number is 608-266-0624. We probably have it up on our Facebook page, too. May well have it up. But Bernie Williams, if you go to the DNR website, say, you know, if you can't find it by phone, if you go to the DNR website, put in crazy worms and search.
Yeah, the fact sheet will come up.
The fact sheet's going to come up.
Yeah, and it'll have the number there and Bernie's email, too.
And thanks again, Dorothy. Nancy and Thorpe, your turn. Hi, Nancy.
I have a question about if I make a raised bed.
Mm-hmm.
I have two questions, actually. But if I make a raised bed, do I have to use treated wood, or can I just use wood I have on hand, or what? And then the second question is, I have a established asparagus bed that has quack grassy kind of weeds in it. And I'm wondering if I can put, like, hot water, because I'm a little, it's cold, a little cool here. I have a late start on my perennials and such, so can I pour some regular vinegar water with a water, you know, the mixture that they say for, that kills grass or weeds or whatever, or can it be hot or whatever? So those are the two questions I have.
Okay. Well, we'll answer the raised bed question first. So you don't want to use any wood that has been treated with a chemical preservative because those are typically, not that they're using arsenate too much anymore, but they have in the past. But still, the copper and other preservatives are not something that you want to use in your vegetable garden. On the other hand, you don't want to use untreated wood either because it will rot. So you can use pressure-treated wood, or you can use cedar, which is rot-resistant, or you can use composite lumber that we talked about earlier in the program that is a composite of plastic and recycled wood, and that will never rot. So either of those would be fine for your raised beds. And keeping weeds out of your asparagus bed, the quack grass is unfortunately a perennial, so even if you pour boiling water on it, it may kill off the top, but it will not kill off the root system. The roots are fairly deep and wide-spreading. Vinegar is also used. Actually, the vinegar you have in your pantry is only about 5% acetic acid, and while it may work on small annual seedlings, it will not do diddly squat for perennial weeds. So you can use 30% acetic acid. There are some labeled products for that, but those are dangerous to handle. You can actually get burned by the acetic acid in those. And, of course, it can burn your asparagus as well. What I usually recommend for grass that is in perennial beds or asparagus beds is that you use Roundup, but that you do it in a specific way, which is that you use the so-called glove of death, where you mix up the Roundup and you get a rubber glove for your hand, and then you put a cotton glove over the top, and you dip your fingers, gloved, of course, in the Roundup. The cotton glove absorbs the Roundup. you make sure that it's not so wet that it's dripping, but then you just run your fingers up the stems of the grass. Now, if you have a lot of the grass, that becomes a bigger yeah. issue. Then you may want to use a grass killer product that is specifically meant to kill grasses. Roundup will kill grasses and broadleaves.
Mm-hmm. So lots to think about. Sue and Facebook wondered about coffee grounds as a mulch for keeping weeds out of an asparagus bed. She probably has access to
that would take a lot of coffee. you know, coffee grounds can be a good mulch, although they do tend to, if they're very thick, there are some species of fungi that will grow on them, and then you get mold on them. But they will not stop weeds that are flying in by seeds, so dandelion seeds can still germinate in there. And it won't stop perennial weeds that are already in the bed from coming up. But I would say not using straight coffee grounds as a mulch, because there are some tannins and alkaloids in there. I would mix it with other compost or mulch products.
Mm-hmm. There we go. And Nancy, again, thank you. And Sue, thank you for your questions. And Robert in Gurnee, Illinois. Hi, thanks for calling.
Yes, real quick, thanks for having me on. Opinion about compost bin in the garden or outside the garden?
Okay, so do you have your compost bin, plunk it right in the garden, or do you?
You can certainly do that. It would make transporting it back and forth a lot quicker and so on. There's, I don't think, really an advantage keeping it outside the garden. Generally, you set up your compost close to where you need to spread it. And actually, some people do in plot composting, where they do trench composting, you know, where they bury stuff, and then, of course, you have to leave that area fallow for a year while the compost becomes compost, where it dissolves. But I don't see a problem with putting it inside the garden if you'd like. It does, of course, take up space, so
yep.
That's about the only disadvantage.
The downside, yeah. But if you've got the room, why not?
Go for it.
Joan in Baraboo. Hello. Thanks for calling, Joan.
Hey, thanks for taking my call, and thanks for the show.
Sure.
The lady that called about the ammonia and water that she was told about with hostas, the ammonia and water is a fertilizer that my grandmother used to fertilize her houseplants, her foliar houseplants.
Sure, I could see that. It's a nitrogen source.
Right.
So but you I need to be careful.
I think she misunderstood what really the best thing to use that for was, because it would indeed, you know, it with the nitrogen it would make things green up very quickly and nicely, and I've used that for years. It's a cheap fertilizer.
Yeah, you need to be very careful though about the proportions that you use so that you don't burn roots. I wouldn't recommend it for new seedlings.
Oh no, I would use these only on established. I have a lot of hostas, and you know, for me to fertilize them all. This way, I can go in there and I can just spray them all. And it does. A bottle of ammonia from the store has a surfactant in it, so it also helps it stick to the foliage, so it can work, do its job.
If people are going to use it, though, I would recommend they try it on a small area first, as opposed to using it wholesale. And again, I can't technically recommend it, even though it may work just fine for you.
Yeah.
But I'm glad that you clarified that, because I hadn't heard of it being used as an insecticide either.
Yeah.
No, I had not either, and that's why I'm thinking that maybe my grandma knew what she was doing, because she's done it for years.
Yeah, it is a nitrogen source.
Yes, right. So it's a fast-acting thing for you. So, okie-dokie, thank you. Great.
Yeah, thank you, Joan, for calling. I appreciate your call. And we still have some open lines, 1-800-642-1234. Bob in Oak Park, Illinois, you are next. Hi, Bob.
Hi, thank you. I've got another question about asparagus, and it's about the planting depth. I know that they're supposed to be about 8 inches down. My problem is I've got a clay layer that starts at about 10 inches down. Mm. I put in asparagus. They did great for a few years, and then I think they all rotted out because they all died.
Yeah.
I was wondering, can they be planted shallower?
They can be planted at about 4 to 6 inches deep. 6 inches is better, but I do think that if you've had problems with them before, you probably will continue to have issues in that area because that, you know, when you get rain, that clay layer acts as a barrier, and you just get moisture sitting in that area. And I know that Chicago area and northern Illinois is very heavy clay, so you have my sympathy with that. I don't know whether planting in berms might be helpful for you.
Or a raised bed of some
sort. Or a raised bed. Yes, maybe I'll have to go to that instead to solve this problem. But they did so well, and then they just all died.
Yeah.
Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm. Yep, thanks for calling. Remember, my dad planted some asparagus 6 inches down the same year I did the normal, you know, the way you're supposed to do it. None of mine came up, and it was all beautiful.
Yeah, they've done some research at Ohio State that says that they don't need to be planted as deep as previously thought.
Carol on Facebook said, I have a garden that can only be in one place in the yard. The tomatoes die off the past few years from the bottom up. Are there varieties of tomatoes that may be resistant to blights?
There are. I would say that if this is a soil-borne issue, though, that probably your best bet is to grow your tomatoes in pots or a raised bed. But with the raised bed, you're still going to have the same issue. It just the idea is with tomatoes that we rotate the areas that we grow them in because the soil-borne pathogens that bother them tend to build up when they're grown in the same area time after time. And I do realize that, you know, not having or having a restricted area for sun obviously restricts where you can grow your tomatoes. So I'd recommend growing them in pots where you can discard the soil after a couple seasons.
Or straw bales.
Straw bales would work too.
I have wonderful luck with straw bales. With my tomatoes. I use huge amounts of tomatoes every year in those straw bales. So you might take a look at Straw Bale Gardening, the book Straw Bale Gardening, or online. There's lots of information about it. It's a way around some of these thorny little issues.
Yeah. My colleague Joe Mullenberg is going to be doing a class on straw bale gardening at our office in May. So you may want to check at our website. I don't know that it's up yet, but it should be up by next week.
So, and early May, do you know?
I think it's near the end of May, actually.
Okay, so that will be interesting to learn about for sure. We had Jill in La Crosse, and because of the time here, I'm just going to say that she had inherited an herb garden, but oregano keeps
coming back in. It's vigorous.
How do you get rid of the oregano?
You can dig it out, or you can treat it with Roundup. That's pretty much your options. Yeah, it is quite aggressive, and if you let it go to seed, it can reproduce from seed as well. So making sure after it flowers that you, or during flowering, that you take off the blossoms will help you keep it in control too. But yeah, basically digging it up or treating it with an herbicide are your choices.
Pretty much the whole thing.
Yeah, and you probably will have to kind of dig away at the edges to keep it from continuing to spread.
And would you mulch hostas with oak leaves?
Sure, you can do that. Yeah, that's a good mulch. The only problem is that it gives slugs a place to hide. But, you know, the bark mulch does the same thing. So, but, yeah, oak leaves are fine.
If you
they
got
don't
lots
pack,
of them, why,
so.
Yeah, that, if you got lots of them, why not?
Yeah.
Well, Lisa, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much, and we'll look forward to your next visit. Hopefully
okay,
soon.
Thank you.
Lisa Johnson, our guest, the horticulture educator for UW Extension in Dane County, and she will be back, and of course, love to have her back on the Ideas Network, and then every Friday on Garden Talk, as you know, we have a new person coming in or a different person coming in. She will be back one of these days. Just to take a look ahead, Monday at 11, our physical therapist Bill Boisenault and Lori Tan Brody come by to talk about curing those aches and pains and sprains and strains. Lots of those out there this time of the year. I've got a few myself. I carried those 80-pound salt bags downstairs, and I'm feeling it today a little bit. Thank you all for listening, and please stay with us. Lots in store on the Ideas Network.